The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only. The topics discussed should not be used to diagnose, treat, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cashlack Memorial Hospital. In short, we are responsible if you screw up. Please do your homework and let us know if we got something wrong.
Ira, I am so excited to record with you on our final episode of season 3 of the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine.
Whoa, whoa. You made it.
I made it. Can I jinx you? I guess yes. That would be terrible for the rest of the show because then neither of us could talk. It'd be super awkward. So I unjinx you if that's how it works.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine, our mini series on substance use disorders. I'm Dr. Carolyn Chan, and I'm joined by my incredible co-host, Dr. Ira Krzyzanowska. On tonight's episode, we'll discuss all things vaping with Drs. Ling and Dr.
BJ Raghavan.
Amazing. Before we get started with that, Ira, will you remind the audience what we do on the show?
You got it, Carolyn. We are the addiction medicine podcast that uses expert interviews to demystify common addiction medicine topics, reduce stigma, and inspire listeners to be fierce advocates for all individuals who use substances. And a reminder that most episodes are available for CME credit through VCU Health CE for all health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. And by listening to this episode and completing CME, this can also be counted towards the new DEA 8-hour requirement on substance use disorders education.
This podcast is brought to you by our partners, the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine. We were so grateful for their support this season. ACAM offers a variety of products that support your professional development and career journey. So stay up to date on the latest addiction medicine with the Professional Practice Bundle, or be sure that you are ready to pass the ABPM board exam with ACAM's Board Prep Bundle. ACAM is the resources you need to excel in academic addiction medicine through networking, fellowship opportunities, and additional educational resources. They have a ton of great webinars for folks on so many helpful topics. So be sure that you visit ACAM at acaam.org.
And we have a fantastic conversation with our two guests, Drs. Ling and Vijay Raghavan. So Dr. Maya Vijayaraghavan is a practicing general internist and a researcher in tobacco control with a focus on populations experiencing homelessness at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Vijayaraghavan is the director of the UCSF Smoking Cessation Leadership Center, a center focused on eliminating disparities in tobacco use prevalence. Through her work, she has intervened at the individual, community, health system, and policy level to help increase access to cessation resources. Her intervention research, funded by the NIH and other organizations, stems from collaborations with community organizations and healthcare systems to promote tobacco control policies that support cessation.
We are also joined by Dr. Pamela Ling, who is a professor of medicine and the director of the Center for Tobacco Control Research and Education at the University of California, San Francisco. Her research focuses on tobacco, media, young adults, and the marketing of novel tobacco products and innovative clinical and public health interventions. She has contributed to 3 Surgeon General's reports on tobacco that focus on young people. Dr. Link has an active clinical practice in general internal medicine.
And we learned so much. Carolyn, I'd love to hear, obviously, your pearls. But if I was to tease some pearls, these amazing guests teach us about how to ask about vaping. What are people actually vaping? Where are they doing that? Indoors, maybe? Maybe not. What happens when vaping becomes a problem? Do people drop everything, reach for the vape without thinking about it? And really how to ask those questions. So excited to get into this episode with you.
Totally. And to add on more to that, they also chat about, can we use vapes to help people quit smoking? The age-old question. So we're going to talk a little bit about some of the evidence, how would we talk and discuss the risk versus benefits with our patients. And I think this episode is just really practical for any primary care doc or honestly any physician who needs to feel more comfortable talking to their patients about vaping. So should we kick it off?
Without further ado, let's get to it.
Okay, everybody, this is the part of the show where we get to ask our guests a couple more questions just to get to know them a little bit better. So, Pam, will you kick us off? Do you mind giving us a one-liner to describe yourself?
Yeah, I'm Pam Ling. I'm 56 years old, a general internist, and I'm a tobacco researcher who studies new tobacco products and marketing.
I love it, Pam. Could you include a little something that's not medicine to describe yourself? Either something that you like to do, some other kind of fun fact about you that people might not know?
I I have two cranky teenage children and two cranky teenage cats, and I am a choral singer.
Wow.
I didn't know that.
So there you go.
Wow. Is that the same thing as being in a chorus?
I'm in a chorus. I'm a soprano in the San Francisco Choral Society.
Wow.
Yep. Well, Pam's group is amazing. I got a chance to listen to her this year.
Okay, well, we need to organize that. So maybe that'll be a Curbsiders Addiction Medicine kind of field trip to see Dr. Pam Ling and the choral, choral prowess.
I'm totally in. I will buy my plane ticket.
You should probably buy it now, Carolyn. It's really expensive to get here.
That's fair enough. I feel like that must kind of balance out the cranky cats and the cranky teenagers, like a little bit of self-care in there.
I think that's how I survive the cranky teenagers and cats.
I'm curious, do you have a favorite aspect of kind of working in the field of addiction medicine, working with individuals who smoke cigarettes or within tobacco research in general? What do you enjoy about it?
I love talking to people who are actually using these products because you're always learning something new. One of the challenges of doing research in this area is that the product landscape evolves super rapidly, but that means people are always doing something creative and we're constantly learning from our patients, which I find is really enjoyable.
I agree. It's like a constant lifelong learning, it feels like. Well, maybe we can turn to our other guest, Dr. Maya Vijayaraghavan, which thank you for letting us call you Maya, and Pam, thank you for letting us call you Pam. Do you mind sharing a one-liner to describe yourself and maybe including something that doesn't have to do with medicine?
Sure. I am a 46-year-old woman, an immigrant from India, and have been doing work in tobacco control for the last 15 years, focusing on people experiencing homelessness and other populations where rates are really high. And I'm also faculty in the Division of General Internal Medicine. A couple of things that I enjoy doing. So I have two kids, 10 and 8. And they're, you know, they have their pre-adolescent, you know, teenage moments, but they're, you know, more or less quite enjoyable right now. And it's fun to, you know, play board games. And we're playing this game on like the Japanese feudal culture called Rising Sun right now, which is quite fun. And then I'm just an avid naturalist. I love to be outdoors and love hiking and just, you know, that's the thing that I do all the time, get them to go out and climb all these mountains. Not always, you know, enthusiastically on their end.
I feel like there's so many mountains to climb, like locally and even driving out like 30, 60 minutes. I feel like we have our smorgasbord of mountains, it feels like here.
Yeah. No, I feel like I think the best when I'm walking. Mm. And, you know, when I started doing work with people experiencing homelessness, it was actually right after, it was even during college, and so much of it was doing outreach work and just seeing people in their communities and walking around and getting a sense of the lay of the land. And, wow. You know, I feel like so much of my research work involves that. I am a little less in the field these days, but that is kind of where I started, and I feel like my heart is still there. So like walking and climbing, all of those things, I just am in my zone. No matter how many people are around me.
That's amazing. Do you have a particularly favorite aspect of working in this field?
Yeah. You know, like Pam, I feel it is so fun to talk to people and such a privilege to just learn about their lives and, you know, how open they are around, you know, struggles and challenges and joys, and how all of that is sort of connected to, you know, health behaviors, and for us, particularly around tobacco and vaping and, you know, other substance use. So I think it just has been a real privilege to just have encountered so many people over the last few decades. And having them be part of whatever it is that we are creating in the field of addiction medicine.
That's amazing. I know. I feel like it's always, you know, people ask you like, what's your favorite thing about this place? Or what's your favorite thing about this thing? And it's always like the people. It's always the people, you know, and like the connections and the relational components of it. It's beautiful and totally agree. I just was imagining you, Maya, like walking or climbing with like hundreds of people around. And then also like being like, I love all of you people. It was just, it was an image I had as you were talking just now. But we should probably turn to the case, Carolyn, right?
Yeah. Do you want to read the case? Tell us all about this clinical situation.
Yes, I would love to. I've been waiting so long. All right. Well, our case from Cashlock Memorial is Jess, who is an early career faculty, just kind of starting out in primary care, recently received a message from one of her younger patients on my chart asking about vaping. And it was from Jake, who's a 31-year-old man, who messaged Jess asking if she could recommend a vape to help him stop smoking cigarettes. One of his friends had just read something about vapes being helpful, especially if people have a goal to kind of kick the habit or stop smoking cigarettes, and suggested that Jake do that. And so Jess is reading this MyChart message and realizes she has no idea or doesn't really know much really about vaping in general, and nor that research that Jake's friend suggested that vaping may help people quit cigarettes. So she turns to her expert colleagues, Drs. Ling and Vijay Raghavan, who are known to be familiar with this topic and kind of wanted to prepare to meet with Jake. And so Jess comes to you, and thank you so much, Pam and Maya, for being here to help us. I'm really helping Jess and Jake, but we all know who Jess is in this scenario, and thinking about vaping and hoping we could just start with the basics. You know, when people talk about vaping or they say that they're vaping, what does that mean? Or how do you all kind of start that conversation with patients? And maybe Pam, would you like to go first?
Yes. Vaping is always an interesting conversation to get into. I think for us, it usually comes up in the context of talking about smoking. And so just like this case, right, where you're talking about someone who's smoking, then they get interested in vaping as a potential way to quit smoking. In California, where people use cannabis more than tobacco, when you talk about vaping, it is good to ask about vaping what, because a lot of people are using electronic devices to vape cannabis too, which is not the focus of this case, but good to clarify. And it's also true that because the vaping landscape is changing really rapidly, you know, most electronic cigarettes or vapes have basic components of some kind of a battery, some kind of a heating device, and then either a cartridge or a chamber that contains a solvent that has a liquid in it that has nicotine that then creates an aerosol that's inhaled. Now, with that said, there are tons and tons of different sizes and shapes and concentrations. And, you know, the vapes that were popular 10 years ago when they first came on the market used to look like cigarettes or they looked like pens. In 2018, 2019, we had the explosion of these vapes that look like USB port chargers, really became popular. And even nowadays, vapes have changed again, where they look like, you know, little bottles, or they can look like, you know, drinks or other kinds of shapes. So it's very hard to define vapes by like exactly the size or the shape or the color. And what I typically do is if I ask if someone is vaping, you know, you try to get really just very genuinely curious about what are they talking about? And, you know, if they can tell you what brand it is, if they can tell you what size it is, if they can tell you what the nicotine concentration is, if they can find a picture on their phone, or they bring it with them, as much information as you can get about the device they're actually using is super helpful, because it's very difficult to talk about a vape generically. And you want to be on the same page with your patient as much as possible and be talking about the same device.
I'm curious, when we talk about smoking cigarettes, right, I often ask, how many cigarettes a day are you smoking? How many packs per day? When you're thinking about sort of a parallel with vaping, are you thinking about how many puffs per day? What would be some more specifics that we would want to really sort of dive into with our patients?
Yeah, on that, it's true. It really depends on the device, right? So if someone is using a vape device, which was for a while was the most popular vape on the market, right? And vape device have pods. And each pod has about 200 puffs in it. So rather than have people do a lot of math about how many puffs are you using, you usually can ask them, like, how long does a pod last you? Right. If someone is doing a pod a day, that's about the nicotine equivalent of a pack of cigarettes per day. So if a pod lasts you 2 days, that's about half a pack a day. You know, if someone has a new device, though, that has 5,000 puffs, that's like, you know, 25 packs of cigarettes. So they may say, you know, my vape device lasts me a week. And if you can look up the device, you can then kind of calculate back roughly as to how does that compare to cigarettes per day in a really rough sense. So I kind of ask about it like that. I don't know, Maya, you might have a different way of asking about quantity.
Yeah, no, you're right, Pam. The important message is that it's not like directly translatable. You know, there is some guessing, and a lot of people are not completely aware of how much and what concentration. And so I think asking these questions is a good way to get a sense of like how much are they needing to use it and how many pods, how are they puffing? Is it like throughout the day at times, like getting a sense, is it, you know, regular use or just, you know, intermittent use? So getting a sense of their, I guess, their consumption, similar to what we would ask for cigarettes. We ask about, you know, time to first cigarette after waking. We ask about number of cigarettes smoked per day, whether they're smoking daily or some days. Those are your like classic measures of nicotine dependence. So I think there are some parallels for vaping dependence that the research field is, you know, honing in on. And some of that is how frequently, how much, how many puffs. And those are all some of the measures that, you know, we can adopt in clinical practice that we're using in research surveys and to assess use patterns.
I had a question that's probably totally off topic. I'm just going to apologize in advance to Carolyn and all of our listeners. But when y'all were saying like how many puffs and like 2,500 puffs, I had a moment where I was like, is anyone regulating these puffs? Like, is there any kind of, I don't know, oversight in like the one kind of device allowing you 200 puffs, another one having like, you know, 25X that? Like, is there, this might be a later conversation and you can definitely say you're a postpone this, but I just wonder for both of you all from a kind of regulatory perspective, like how is it possible that, you know, and how do people choose is crazy to me. And when you have all these options.
Yeah. So from a regulatory standpoint, the FDA does have authority over e-cigarettes and vapes as part of its authority over tobacco products. But the FDA has only actually approved a handful of actual products on the market. So technically, all the vapes on the market are not legal. But it's extremely difficult to enforce these limits. So we're in a situation where the products on the market far outstrip the regulations. And the FDA does have the authority to say, limit the strength of nicotine or limit the size of the device. But that just hasn't been done yet. There are some other countries, like in the UK, they've limited the concentration of nicotine to below 3%, I think. And we don't have that kind of limit here. So we have a very common concentration here is 5% nicotine, which is illegal in some other places. And you can have devices that have as many as 10,000 puffs, for under $20. So it's, and I don't know how people choose. Maybe, you know, there's actually a lot of advertising on the internet.
Yeah.
I think a lot of times people choose what looks cool, what seems intriguing. Again, if you are trying to get maximum nicotine for cheapest price, that's why those big devices seem like a good deal, right? Mm-hmm. Under $20 or under $10 for like, you know, 5,000 puffs, it sounds like a good deal. And then, of course, you have really enticing flavors like watermelon ice and creme brulee. And you sort of get curious about if that really tastes like a creme brulee. And so I think a lot of times we ask people about their choices. And I think it's a little bit of a combination of what's intriguing, what's popular, what does your friend have, what captures your imagination. And the concern about these really large sizes and increasing concentrations, though, is that you can really, you know, become quite addicted to the nicotine without really realizing it, because I don't think people really necessarily think of like a vape device can hold in your hand having, you know, over a carton or two cartons worth of nicotine in it. So if you're just kind of slowly making your way through one, it's hard to think about that. That's actually a ton of nicotine.
I could totally see a patient making the switch and actually getting more exposure to nicotine, because exactly as you said, you can't quantify it in really the same way. And it's almost easier to kind of forget about it. But what kind of come next in this conversation in the office for an individual who's vaping in your practice?
So I can say, you know, how I approach this. I think the challenge with any behavior is to just make sure that we don't come across as judgmental, right? And with any sort of substance use and tobacco use behavior. So it's really coming at the perspective of like curiosity about, you know, what are people doing? And we have intake questions for tobacco use. We have, you know, intake questions for e-cigarettes, vaping, and I think following up a little bit more as we would with tobacco use around how are they using their product? What are they using? And from the perspective of genuinely wanting to know more and also understanding motivations for use and, you know, what do they get out of it and how much are they spending? So these are some of the questions that I would ask about tobacco use as I get to know someone. And approaching it from that perspective is really helpful because it gives you the information to tailor your advice later on, depending on, you know, whether they're using e-cigarettes or vapes to quit cigarette smoking, whether they're using it for different reason entirely, whether they're using it for cannabis use. I think you can just get a lot of information if you're approaching it from the sense of curiosity about your patient and their life and, you know, their health behavior. So that's one way to, you know, circumvent these conversations. And we actually have these conversations all the time with people in community settings because they too have, you know, reticence to bring up anything that could potentially feel like they're infringing upon people's lives and their privacy. And there are ways to open up these conversations just from the perspective of, hey, I'm like really curious to know, you know, how you're using your vapes, or if you're using tobacco, are you also using other products? We often find people using multiple products, just curious to know how you're using it. And that perspective, I feel, allows there to be an open conversation. And it's one approach that I've been using a lot more recently. I will say that people are open about talking about it because they are interested in finding out more too. And just like we are interested to know long-term effects and, you know, how it can be used if people are using it for cessation, people genuinely are interested to learn about that too. So it can actually open up a dialogue if we ask about the use of e-cigarettes and vapes. So that's one approach. Pam, I can pass it on to you.
I'm thinking about, you know, there are some research measures for things like dependence that you can kind of weave in to a conversation about vaping. So if someone, yes, is vaping last thing before they go to bed and first thing when they wake up in the morning, if they're sleeping with a vape under their pillow or at their bedside, or if they're waking up in the middle of the night to vape, just like if someone would wake up to smoke cigarettes, that can be a sign of dependence. People who sometimes vape more before they're going someplace where they know they won't be able to. So kind of pre-game vaping or pre-vaping can be a sign of dependence. People will often tell you if they get cravings or if they have withdrawal symptoms, especially with the stronger vapes now. Young people will definitely be able to tell you if they get anxious, if they start to really worry or have to prioritize what they're doing in order to get the vape when it's starting to run down. And sometimes people are very open about saying they feel like they're getting addicted to it. Sometimes people will avoid the addiction label, but they'll relate to those kinds of situations or those feelings. So a lot of those kinds of aspects sound to me like what we do when we talk to people about smoking too, right? It's just a little bit different. So the quantification, I agree with Maya, quantifying it is not as important as it's kind of getting at some of these elements that might suggest like this person needs nicotine replacement.
Yeah. And this kind of reminds me of the way we talk about, you know, substance use disorder in general. It's like, what is the impact? What's the role that this substance is playing in your life? And so if you're waking up to vape, or that vape is like under your pillow, super close to you, and you're, you know, those are all signs that this is playing a huge role in your life and really kind of potentially getting in the way, or maybe the, you know, harms are starting to outweigh the benefits in terms of a kind of a dependence or a, you know, behavioral component happening too. And I know we're focusing kind of more of our conversation, obviously, on nicotine delivery systems in terms of when we say vaping or when we're referring to that in this podcast. Is there anything else that you all kind of make sure to ask in the conversation around the actual kind of delivery system, the e-cig, the pen, whatever people kind of are using as you're gathering this history that we haven't mentioned yet relative to, I don't know, cartridge size, or, you know, we just talked about the flavors. Is there something else that you make a point of to ask in your conversations with patients?
You know, one thing I do ask is whether they use it indoors, because we spend a lot of time actually, you know, counseling our patients to take their, you know, cigarettes outdoors and to not use it indoors. And one question I do ask is like, are you using, you know, are you using your vape indoors? And I guess engender some awareness around that. A lot of people are potentially using it indoors because they feel like they can. It's not the same as cigarettes. Like, it opens up a chance for conversation. So that's one question that I ask that we haven't talked about.
Yeah, and I briefly mentioned cannabis co-use. Again, it's not really the focus of this case, but it's so common in one of our studies where we're enrolling young people in a vaping cessation study, 80% of them were co-using cannabis. So because it's a common behavior, and sometimes people can actually use cannabis in the same device, but a lot of times people have just different vaping devices. But I think vaping one substance can make it pretty easy to switch over to the other. And particularly in California, where we have restrictions that get rid of nicotine flavored vapes, flavored cannabis vapes have been filling in with flavors in that context. So those two devices are very easy to switch out with each other. And people have really interesting perspectives on willingness to quit one or quit the other, and whether they're addicted to one or addicted to the other. But I think there are some concerns that co-use of both nicotine and cannabis might be more challenging around cessation.
These are such great points. I've never considered to ask patients about where they're vaping. So if they are vaping indoors, are you counseling them? Do we think of this as risk of secondhand smoke to others around them? How would you sort of counsel a patient on like the specific risks of like vaping indoors versus choosing to take it outdoors?
Yeah, it's such a good point, because we know that people are using multiple products, right? There might be cannabis, there might be, you know, cigarettes, there might be e-cigarettes or vapes. And we are talking more and more from, you know, smoke-free policies to clean air policies that encompass all of these different products. And when we think about our current smoke-free policies, certainly there are comprehensive policies involve, you know, including e-cigarettes and also cannabis. And particularly in settings where I work a lot, like multi-unit housing, where you do have yet smoke and aerosol going from one unit to the other through ventilation, that it becomes all the more important to talk about, you know, potential repercussions of being exposed from a perspective of someone who's not using it, and also from the perspective of someone who's using it. So we bring it up all the time, actually. Mm. We even ask them, do you use it indoors? Do you use it outdoors in your balcony? And do you use, you know, cannabis? Are you using it indoors, outdoors? So we ask, because I think it does open up a chance to introduce the idea that one of the steps to think about when you're trying to reduce or stop is really, you know, getting your ducks in order and changing some of your internal, you know, environmental cues to help you move in that direction. And actually taking it outdoors means that you have to take everything, go out. It poses, you know, some challenges and burdens to have to do that all the time. And it allows people to think about their behavior a little bit more and is one step that we've found, at least from smoking cessation perspective, like taking their cigarettes outdoors is one way to help people quit. So that parallel could potentially be there for e-cigarettes. And, you know, we think it's good for us to start having those discussions just so that we get people thinking about it.
Maya, I love that you're already touching on like ways to get people to maybe not use the things that we've been talking about already. I wonder just to, and also to touch on the kind of clean air and the government involvement in all of this. We had mentioned earlier that, you know, the FDA has control over certain nicotine delivery systems. And I wonder, as we think about like what is approved, if anything is approved for certain indications in terms of kind of e-cigarettes, what are those things? And is there, you know, a time where we have evidence, we'll say, or indications to recommend e-cigarettes to our patients? Kind of feel free to really expound on what evidence we do and don't have when we think about e-cigarettes.
So in relation to your first question around, you know, the comprehensive smoke-free policies, inclusive e-cigarettes and cannabis, there are states that definitely have exemptions for these things. So not, you know, all states have such policies that include these products. So there is variation both at the state and at the local level. So that's something to keep in mind. I think the issue around whether e-cigarettes are part of the armamentarium for smoking cessation is a really important topic for us to discuss. And I think we can start by saying currently, you know, in the United States, the FDA has not approved e-cigarettes for smoking cessation. So there's no general guidance, just like we have for the other FDA approved aids for smoking cessation, for e-cigarettes in that use or capacity. There are reasons for that, right? And one, some of the main reasons are, you know, we don't know enough about long-term safety. We know from observational studies that people oftentimes are using, you know, may have an intention to use e-cigarettes for smoking cessation, but end up also using cigarettes. So they're not, they're dual using and they're not entirely quitting cigarettes. So you're having the use of both products. But there are clinical trials around the use of e-cigarettes. And what we know is that in those clinical trial conditions, which are quite strict, many of them are using some of the older e-cigarette products. And, you know, your time points in clinical trials are short in some ways. So you measure outcomes at 6 months. At the most, you might follow people for like 1 or 2 years, but you don't know, you know, down the line how people are doing. In those very controlled situations, you do see that e-cigarettes do help people quit smoking. But it's hard to replicate that when people are using it in real world settings and using it in any way, and maybe using the newer products with much higher doses of nicotine. So I think those are the realities to confront. And, you know, I think it becomes a case by case discussion with patients. You know, the message is that it's really hard to stop smoking. It takes multiple tries. People feel oftentimes, I'm sure you've heard, you know, other patients say, I've like stopped everything, but this is just really hard to do. And it's validating that it is really hard, that we do have approved aids. We should recommend that. A lot of times it means going back to the same aid that they've tried before, and it may not have worked, to think about how to use it in a better way. And if that doesn't work and they want to try an e-cigarette, then I think you can think about a case-by-case scenario where you really discuss, you know, the goal is to stop cigarettes. You can use your e-cigarette for that purpose, but then the goal is to also stop e-cigarettes once you've, you know, gotten to that point. So that's sort of like getting into the discussion, but there's just a lot more that we can unpack in there.
Pam, I don't know if you wanted to add anything. That was amazing, yeah. Maya. I'm just pausing because I'm like letting it all sink in and reminding myself what I have to say to patients next time.
Yeah. No, I agree with Maya. I think there are this meta-analyses and there are some clinical trial data. So say that under randomized controlled clinical trial conditions, e-cigarettes have shown efficacy for smoking cessation. Mm-hmm. And the problem is, if you look at the epidemiologic data on how people in the real world using e-cigarettes as they do, most of whom are trying to quit smoking, we don't see a benefit in terms of cessation when we look at the epi population data. So I think there you really are seeing some of the challenges of, you know, the differences between the conditions of randomized clinical trials and, you know, go out and find a vape and do your best. I think to the extent if when you're counseling a patient who, you know, you have some patients who say, not only have they quit everything, but some patients have said, I have already tried everything to quit smoking and nothing works. And then when you explore with them a little bit, what I tried everything actually means, sometimes they've tried some kind of nicotine replacement, but they chewed the gum wrong, or they didn't have a high enough dose, or they, you know, cut the nicotine patch in half. They may or may not have actually tried approved pharmacotherapy. So sometimes getting in a little bit to what you've tried can be, the e-cigarette can open up the conversation. But I often try to explore still what tried everything meant. But you do have some patients who are like, this is what I want to use. I have this vape. I'm going to use it to quit smoking. And in those cases, I think we do our best to try to replicate as much as possible the conditions of a controlled trial. It is true that the controlled trial e-cigarettes are really not the same as what's on the market. Now, I mean, even the vape device, which was popular several years ago, is not the kind of vape that was used in the clinical trials. They were using even older vapes than that. Mm. And currently, the kind of vapes we have on the market now were not even tested in these conditions. So, but seeing that, okay, we know in clinical trials, everyone gets counseling, right? Everyone gets at least regular, maybe weekly minimum counseling. They were really encouraged to switch completely from cigarettes to e-cigarettes. Not everybody achieves that, but that is the goal. So really trying to reinforce that, because dual use of cigarettes plus e-cigarettes probably isn't benefiting you much. And I agree with Maya that also thinking about, you know, if your end goal is to try to quit, a lot of people, you know, will say that they also don't want to become addicted to e-cigarettes later. Mm-hmm. So that kind of mindless use of an unknown amount really isn't ideal, right? So thinking about how to be mindful about how much you're using, still trying to reduce the frequency and intensity of using the e-cigarettes in the longer run if you're able to switch over from cigarettes. And then thinking about how, you know, and again, we're sort of in the data-free zone, but in terms of abuse liability, right, e-cigarettes that deliver nicotine very rapidly to the brain are going to be more reinforcing than nicotine gum or nicotine patches. So in the longer run, trying to switch back to another form of nicotine replacement to perhaps as a pathway to becoming completely quit. If you're like in the boat with the patient and you're doing it together, right, you can continue to negotiate that. So we try to meet people where they're at, but you are totally in the data free zone.
Yeah. And it's important to, you know, validate the intention to want to stop cigarettes. And I think that if e-cigarettes is part of that process for people, we definitely, you know, support, but at the same time, like bring back to the fact that there isn't a whole lot of information and that, you know, ideally we'd want people to stop both, but definitely stop cigarettes completely. So to not do both at the same time, which a lot of times I've heard people started and then they're also using cigarettes at the same time.
Right.
We don't want them to be in that situation.
Well, Pam, you've given us so much to think about from kind of the e-cigarette perspective and what to do when someone says, you know, I want to use e-cigarettes in my journey to quit cigarettes. I heard like avoiding dual use. I heard counseling. I heard kind of matching trial criteria.
I wonder if we can spend some time when maybe the intention of trying to quit cigarettes and using e-cigarettes may have led to a situation where use of e-cigarettes has become chaotic, or there may have been now a possibility of a use disorder related to the actual vape. I wonder broadly, how do you talk to patients about this? Or how do you even, you know, screen for the possibility that e-cigarette use is too much or is causing that there might be an addiction there?
You know, some of these questions we touched upon, and Pam, you had mentioned, you know, just asking about whether they need to use it first thing in the morning, whether they need to use it at night, if they have it readily available under their bed. So like getting at just the use patterns, the dependence patterns is really helpful. And getting a sense of like, are they stopping doing other things in order to go vape, and allowing people to think through those how it's deeply impacting their life, and they need to go out every 5 minutes to do that, and if it's impacting their work life. So getting a sense of that could be really helpful, and to help us move towards discussions around how to stop it. But I know, Pam, there are some measures that we're using on the research side around dependence.
Yeah, so there are some research measures, some of which are maybe a little bit long for clinical practice, just like, but, you know, there are like 9 or 10 item e-cigarette dependence scales that we use in research. There's a 4-item shorter version that I use in research with young people because, you know, they don't give you a lot of time. And those measures are things like, do you reach for your vape? How frequently do you reach for your vape without thinking about it? Do you drop everything to go out to get your vapes or your juice? We talked about, like, do you vape more before you're going to be in a situation where you can't vape? And do you have, like, cravings? Do you get really bad or intolerable cravings when you can't vape? So some of those questions, you know, we use to diagnose dependence on e-cigarettes. And those are the kinds of questions that I think you could kind of incorporate into a clinical conversation. I think asking people if they feel addicted or if they think they're addicted is also totally legit, because I think you're right. You have more and more these days with these strong vapes. You have patients who maybe started because they wanted to quit cigarettes. I work with young people. I have a whole bunch of young people now, right, that just started because they were curious. And then now are starting to feel like, yeah, I'm maybe addicted. I'm having trouble stopping. And I think now the people who are working in the tobacco quit lines will also say like 20-30% of the people who call the quit line actually want help with quitting vaping, not just quitting smoking. So there's an increasing demand for strategies to quit vaping.
Yeah, I would agree that even in, you know, some of our work, we are seeing people who are enrolled in smoking cessation trials. And these are people who are using like multiple products, you know, and other substances, that they're also using vapes. You know, they're recognizing that it's not really helping them stop smoking. They're also using vapes, and that they are interested in getting some advice for vaping cessation separate from smoking cessation. So I do feel like there is a growing need for it, and that it does benefit us to ask people whether they're interested in stopping use.
And what are our options? So if somebody is interested, are we thinking of the exact same things in the exact same manner as we are for cigarettes? Like, what would be sort of your approach for like pharmacotherapy and psychosocial supports?
Yeah, so maybe it's good to talk through, you know, what do we do for smoking cessation? So for smoking cessation, we definitely recommend, you know, combination nicotine replacement therapy or varenicline as our first line options with counseling. And we know that it's the combination of the two that's really important, because you're treating the physiologic aspect of nicotine dependence, and then you're treating the behavioral aspect, and that's where the counseling program can be really helpful. And it also sends a message as like, it's not as easy to quit smoking by just putting on a patch, you know, like there are a lot of things that people need to do. And that's why it takes a bit of time and multiple attempts, and that providing support through those attempts can increase your success at quitting. So I think having that as a parallel, the approaches for vaping cessation are similar. And the clinical trials right now have included, you know, some form of counseling program with nicotine replacement therapy. There is a trial on that. There is a trial around counseling with varenicline for a vaping cessation. And there's also a trial more, you know, very recently around cytosine and counseling for vaping cessation. And cytosine is not available in our market in the U.S. yet, but there are clinical trials that have shown its efficacy for smoking cessation. But in other parts of Europe, it is an over-the-counter medication that has been available, I think, for a really long time for smoking cessation. So those are the trials that I know right now for vaping cessation. And we can use some of that guidance for the dosing of these medications for our people who are interested in stopping use.
And my, just to quickly piggyback on that, and sorry, Pam, please jump in if this is feels like the something you were about to say. But when you say use the same dosing, are we literally using the same like varenicline dosing that we would use for smoking cessation or starting somebody on that as a controller therapy?
Yeah, I would start there. And, you know, like our dosing for smoking cessation is, you know, the dose that we use is 1 milligram BID. I think the challenge is when people are using cigarettes and e-cigarettes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'd need to think about combination therapy in those settings. And they're again, these trials are done under very controlled conditions. You know how much people are smoking, and it's possible that the dependence on nicotine is way higher for people who are using multiple products. So it's good to think about, okay, if the standard dosing of varenicline is not helping, do you add on nicotine replacement therapy, similar to what we would do for someone who's smoking and for whom like varenicline at the standard dose is not helping? So I think those permutations are possible. We are kind of in new territory. So some of this guidance is coming out, but I know that there is dosing based on how much people are vaping too. Pam, I think you might have some of this information.
Yeah. Again, we're really just kind of going by not a heavy load of evidence. This is really expert opinion and what people in practice are doing. Mm-hmm. Some of our pharmacy experts will say you can use, if someone is a former smoker, right, you could use how much they were smoking before they started vaping as a little bit of a benchmark as to how much nicotine replacement they might need, right? So if they were a half a pack a day smoker, you would be using a 21 milligram nicotine patch. If you think about, as we talked before, about how a vape device is about the nicotine of a pack of cigarettes, if someone is going through half a pot a day, that's about 10 cigarettes, they, again, will need about a 21 milligram nicotine patch. The advice has also been to really, you're basically taking a guess and then you are checking in with people and probably more frequently. So it's not a set it and forget it situation. It's really like you maybe recommend a nicotine patch or nicotine lozenges, gum, and then you check in frequently about are they, because people tend to underdose nicotine replacement, right? So It may be a check in frequently, encouraging combination therapy or a higher dose, particularly if nicotine replacement. I didn't want to forget, though, about the behavioral support. So again, like all of these medications are not approved for vaping cessation. So, but there are supports, behavioral supports available. So, you know, the California Quit Line, which has renamed itself. It used to be 1-800-NO-BUTS, right? Mm-hmm. And now it's Kick It CA. And that's in part to include vaping and other tobacco use. They actually have a section on the website which is about quitting vaping with advice for vape quitting. The National Cancer Institute's smokefreeteen.gov website has a whole section with advice on how to quit vaping. The Truth Initiative has a free texting program which uses a bot that gives you advice to quit vaping, and they've had hundreds of thousands of mostly young people quit vaping using this free text program. And then we're doing research on a support groups that take place on Instagram called Quit the Hit. And this is a with a trained counselor in groups in the direct messages on Instagram. providing behavioral support, mostly, again, to young people, because that's who's on Instagram. Again, the same principles that we do in tobacco cessation, but making it accessible and relatable to vaping for a young audience. So there are behavioral supports out there that are specifically for vaping. And I think we should pair those with the best we can in terms of pharmacotherapy if folks are open to it.
That's really helpful. And just to even sort of re-summarize some things from the first part of the show, when we're talking about somebody who's maybe using a device that is like 5% nicotine, has 200 puffs, we think that that may be roughly equivalent to a pack per day. So if that's the case, we're kind of thinking if we're dosing the patch, the 21 mcg of nicotine replacement, and if we're thinking about choosing, you know, a short acting like gum or lozenge to help, I'm assuming we're using the same. How long does it take for you to have your first puff in the morning? If it's less than 30 minutes and you're going to use the 4 milligrams, and then greater than that, use the 2. Does that sound right-ish? Or am I totally off base? Or is that like even too much to say in terms of like, we really don't know how much somebody's getting with like the puffs and the different devices?
Yeah, I think our pharmacy colleagues would agree that we would use, you know, especially if someone is using the equivalent of a pack of cigarettes a day, that you would use combination NRT. And the same sort of questioning around, you know, what's the amount and how soon after you're waking, or if they, you know, did use cigarettes before, were they at a pack of cigarettes per day? So like, we know that people will probably need that amount, but I agree with Pam that it is, you know, a lot of check-ins to see whether that is sufficient, it's too much, and then you could titrate based on that, titrate up or down based on how people are feeling.
And Maya and Pam, maybe I could push you just a little bit on this, like, concrete person who's maybe talking to patients and wants to know like what the verbiage is during those check-ins. Like, would I be asking somebody like, do you feel like your cravings are not as strong with the 4 milligram gum or with the 21 milligram patch? Or are you asking some other question, like maybe how long is it taking you? Or maybe how less frequently are you reaching for the vape without thinking about it? Like, are there particular questions that you ask during those frequent check-ins that can give you a sense of how to titrate?
I think first, knowing if they're using NRT with vaping. The idea is that by using it or by using, you know, medications, that it will allow you to stop. Mm-hmm. But if they're co-using still, then I think you want to get a sense of whether it's at all reduced, and, you know, getting a sense of like how they're assessing reduction, like what does it mean for them in their life? Mm-hmm. But I think if they feel like it hasn't really changed, then I think we really need to get a sense of, okay, are people using the NRT as we prescribed, or are they using the varenicline? Is it just really bad side effects? And, you know, is it a lot of nicotine that they're feeling? Like, is it they're feeling really jittery and anxious? And is that because it's all of it is too much? And so those are some of the questions that I might ask. It very much is dependent on just getting a sense of like, okay, are we moving in the right direction? Because it's a process. And a little less of, okay, we've like hit the dose and the first try.
The anion gap is closed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that this is going to like, you know, be enough for you for the next 6 months or whatever.
Right. I know, Pam, if you had anything to add that you usually use or discuss with patients in those check-ins.
I would say that my experience is a little bit different because I have more of a focus on young adults and adolescents who are trying to quit vaping. So there are many fewer have like a cigarette smoking history. A lot of them are just vaping history. And they also have very little enthusiasm for any kind of medication or NRT. So I think the conversations we have really start with behavioral kinds of supports and, you know, even making a plan is, you know, my, if you talk to young people about their plan for quitting smoking, it was like, I told my friend to punch me every time he saw me smoking. And, you know, so like even some of the basics of like having a plan, having, trying to think about what would you do if you have cravings, teaching about box breathing and urge surfing and some ways to just get through those discomforts. And also reinforcing that quitting takes a lot of times. And so that if the first time you try, or, you know, the first structured time you try, it doesn't work, that's normal. We do a lot of that behavioral counseling. And then for folks that really, though, suffer a lot from withdrawal symptoms, that can maybe open up the conversation to saying, you know what, maybe nicotine replacement could be really helpful here to help manage, you know, some of those bad withdrawal symptoms. And I think being with folks through some of the behavioral, so I work with a lot of young people who go through the behavioral stuff first, and then some subset of them may end up deciding that nicotine replacement is, maybe they'll be more open to it if they've worked through that. But I have very few young people who the first thing they want to do is try nicotine replacement or medication.
Well, this is a great time for us to just plug our previous episodes on curbside addiction medicine, because we had one on tobacco from season one and also one on return to use counseling as well, which I think gets at exactly, Pam, what you were saying around, like, what do you do when those urges come up and to kind of, or sorry, the cravings come up, and what are options, and kind of thinking about the people, places, and things that are related to kind of our return to use and our triggers. So if listeners want to check out more, there's some episodes there.
It's true. We've covered so much ground today. I've learned a ton. We've talked about vaping for smoking cessation, how to help people quit vaping, just sort of in the minds of starting to wrap up. Are there any other best practices that you guys feel like we haven't mentioned in just discussing vaping with patients in terms of risk benefits, cessation methods?
I mean, I will end by saying that these discussions are so important, and having them is really, really critical. And, you know, one of the best things that we can do in primary care is talk to people around their smoking and, you know, helping them quit. It's like such an important intervention. I think it will translate in many ways to vaping as well, as the need for, you know, help to quit increases. I often, you know, use it as an opportunity to highlight the fact that there are approved aids, FDA approved aids for cessation, that it is important to engage in some counseling. I highlight, you know, whether there is like on-site resources in clinic or calling KCC California. They have an amazing website. They have amazing coaches in multiple languages. So like highlighting all those resources, many people may know all of it, but they're not always doing all of it at the same time. So using that as a reminder is really helpful. And then like really getting into the conversation around their vaping and what their motivations are. And if they are interested in quitting, then talking through that with them, but making sure that they know that they're not alone.
I will just jump in and say, I agree with Maya, because I always agree with Maya, but no, I agree with Maya. That having the conversation is really the most important thing. I think like tobacco use, I think vaping can be really stigmatized. People, and because it is an area where we don't have a lot of evidence or a lot of knowledge. And, you know, if you're not a person like us who's always looking for the new vapes, it can be intimidating sometimes as a practitioner to ask about this stuff. But just being genuinely curious about what are you doing, which kind of vape it is. I ask people what brands of cigarettes they smoke, because that the brand tells you a lot if someone is paying a, you know, a lot of money for a
certain cigarette brand.
That's a certain kind of priority for smoking than someone who's rolling their own. And similarly with vapes, just what brands, what are they doing? What do they get out of it? What are the, what benefits do they get? What are the downsides, if any? And opening up that conversation to include cannabis, other substances. Again, us, when we use electronic medical records, a lot of these things are not really in the checkboxes in the forms. But I think if you are having these conversations with your patients and they know that you're interested and you can talk about it with them and be curious about it, that just keeps the door open to have further discussions.
I love that. And I also feel like y'all have mentioned so many resources that Jess, in our case, can talk to Jake about. And I heard kind of Kick It California. I heard the National Cancer Smoke-Free Teen.gov, the Truth Initiative, that texting program. I was today years old when I learned that coaches come in multiple languages in Kick It California. So are there other resources that we should, you know, be telling folks about relative to sites to check out, places to call, things like that?
Those are the ones that come to mind. And, you know, I feel like as we are learning more, we ourselves can become resources more so, you know, and that is hopefully a role that we can take on just as we do for tobacco cessation or other substance use, and that we ourselves could, you know, become more familiar and feel comfortable. And I know that this podcast is helping us move in that direction. But I don't know about other, I can't think of other resources right now. Those would be the main ones that I would go to. And they are really good.
That was such a call to action, Maya. I love it. I'm like, we are lifelong learners and we have learned so much and we will use that. Thank you. Should we move on to take home points, Carolyn?
Yeah, I think we're ready.
Okay. Well, Pam, Maya, would love to hear from y'all if there are specific main take-home points for our listeners, in your opinion, around vaping, e-cigarettes, nicotine delivery systems. Maybe, Pam, if you want to go first.
Take-home points. One, right? Ask about vaping. Ask about vaping in a non-judgmental way. Remember vaping what? Right? Like not just vaping nicotine, but ask about vaping what other things. That's one. Two, I would encourage patients not to use vapes the same places where you would smoke cigarettes if they're someone who used to smoke cigarettes. So as Maya said, like all those places where, you know, if you go outside to smoke cigarettes, try doing that for vaping too, because that may help you quit. And it also will help you not use continuously everywhere. And so I think that could help with either not becoming addicted or becoming less addicted to vapes. Three is like, remember for cessation, the same principles that we use for tobacco cessation, right? Behavioral plus pharmacotherapy is probably, at least by expert opinion, probably the most effective strategy that we have. And for, you know, this podcast is awesome. So you should keep listening to it.
Thanks, Pam. Maya, do you want to share some?
I will start with saying that this podcast is awesome. And you should listen to it. Okay. You learn a lot.
We paid them nothing.
No, I agree with Pam completely. I think that, not to belabor the point, but that it is, I will encourage people to think that when we're talking to people, and there are people who have tried many, many times, to be cognizant about that and come back to the fact that it is really hard and that we do have many, many, you know, different forms of support. If vaping ends up being part of that for our patients, that we are clear about helping people stop smoking completely and thinking about a time when they can also be off their vapes as well. And, you know, having those conversations as being part of the process. If in that process they are interested in using, you know, FDA approved aids for cigarette smoking cessation, that is also okay. And then for vaping cessation, you know, that there are expert opinions and that we're constantly finding out more. So that's what I would say.
That's great. Do you all have anything you'd like to plug? So it could be medical, non-medical related.
We just had a commentary in JAMA come out this week around how Philip Morris International Tobacco Company sponsored a bunch of CME for medical providers around tobacco harm reduction. That was really a vehicle to promote their newer tobacco products, including vapes. And so we just published a commentary saying that tobacco companies should not be sponsoring CME in JAMA this week. So I guess I could plug that if folks are inspired to try to stop the tobacco industry from doing our continuing medical education, they're sneaking in there. And we need to be vigilant and encourage our you know, the ACCME and other governing bodies to make policies against allowing tobacco companies to educate healthcare providers.
That's great. We will definitely link that in our show notes so people can take a look, and hopefully we'll hear from some other advocates to sort of join up that cause.
I was just going to say one thing, which is now that you're talking about the plug and talking about legitimate CME, we do have several webinars actually that are relevant to the topic that the Smoking Cessation Leadership Center has that are coming up. And these are also archived and including topics on e-cigarettes and vaping. So definitely feel free to check it out.
Great. Thanks so much. Well, thank you guys so much for your time. This episode was great. I think folks are going to learn a ton and will hopefully be much more comfortable just talking to their patients about vaping. So thanks again, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been another episode and the final episode of our Curbsiders Season 3 miniseries, The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine. So get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/addiction.
And we're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at curbsidersaddictionmed@gmail.com. And a special thanks to Dr. Matt Watto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support in this project, as well as ACAM, the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine. Learn more about the organization at acam.org. And until next time, I've been Dr. Ira Krzyzanowskaja.
A special thanks to our producer for this episode, Dr. Ira Krzyzanowskaja, as well as Kento Sonoda, who was our incredible reviewer, as well as to our entire team. It takes a lot of folks to help keep the season running and moving forward, and it's just been so wonderful to work with everybody this season. So The Curbsiders is produced and edited by the team at Podbase. Ooh. Reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcohealth.org, where all you have to do is make an account. And until next time, next season, hopefully, I've been Dr. Carolyn Chan, and thank you so much for tuning in this season and letting us bring you some addiction medicine pearls.
And thank you, Carolyn. We forgot to thank someone very special, which is you. Thank you for making this season happen and for kind of keeping our team on track. You're the best. Okay, now everyone can learn.